It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station, FM 107.1. And of course, joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as I begin the program, I want to remind you, you're welcome to give them a call at any time. And in matter of fact, they would appreciate it. A 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. To find out more information about the law firm and all the services they provide, go online to harvellandcollins.com. Harvell and, spell out the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com. So with that brief introduction, good afternoon to you, Cecil.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
And to you, Wes, good afternoon as well.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
All right. The conversation today will be what?
Last week, Lockwood, Wes and I discussed contesting a will, challenging a will. How does that work? What are some of the circumstances whereby someone would feel inclined to challenge a will, to contest a will? It certainly is something that we see a lot at our law firm. Wes has been involved in countless cases concerning contesting wills. And so today, let's decipher some of the mechanics of that and exactly how that happens. One of the things that I'd like for Wes to talk about, maybe right out of the gate, is what I think is so fascinating. Wes, isn't it true that a will contest is a jury trial? Is that accurate?
It's always a jury trial. The issue of let me make sure I say this right. It's Latin, divazit vel non, and basically it's, the thing is what it is. It's the will is the will.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just, so that issue always goes to a jury. Now, I've seen the courts get confused a little bit with that, and there's really been some interesting history, not to get off on too much of this topic, but for years in the jurisprudence of North Carolina, every single will caveat, went to a jury. And then maybe 40, 50 years ago, the court started taking into consideration dismissals of these cases on a summary judgment if there wasn't sufficient evidence to support some of the elements. So some of the cases, would not make it to a jury because the evidence wasn't strong enough on undue influence or lack of capacity. And that's pretty much where we are now, that, if your case isn't strong enough, the superior court where it lies, all these cases lie, could get dismissed on a summary judgment if you don't have, the basic evidence for undue influence or lack of capacity to go forward with the caveat. So it's always a jury issue, but you still have to get through the hurdles of some of the things we've talked about on the program, such as, dismissals, motions to dismiss, and motions for summary judgment.
All right. Let me interrupt, if I may, here for a moment. Wes Collins, of course, with us this afternoon. We're talking about the issue of challenging a will. I have two questions. One, very quickly, the word caveat. Is that, in essence, the term you're using for challenge?
Yeah, that's the statutory term.
Okay.
The caveat is, it's not a lawsuit, so to speak. It looks like a lawsuit, but a lawsuit in the world of which, litigation attorneys speak is normally going to be a plaintiff versus defendant type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like breach of contract, negligence, these type of things, where you have a claim and you bring that claim and the plaintiff is suing the defendant. There may be other parties, but that's just the basic framework. A caveat is different, is codified in our statutes, and it's a process where, again, you have a jury, you have a judge, you're in court, you do discovery, so it looks very much like your normal lawsuit, plaintiff versus defendant, but really it's an opportunity for all parties who are interested to come to the court and to put on whatever evidence they think is relevant, and for the court to make a determination as to whether the thing being the will is the will or not the
okay.
will.
In other words, it's a contest of a document, not of an individual or an action. It's actually the contest of the document itself. Is that a fair description?
That's right, and there are different the statutory procedures that take place that are a little different than a normal lawsuit, but you know, it's 90% like a lawsuit, put it that way.
Okay.
It's 10% that makes it a little bit different.
The other question I have, and we normally when we're talking about wills and reading of the will and the actions on the will usually involves the clerk of court. I'm curious, if there's a challenge or a concern to a challenge to a will, is that initiated with that clerk of court activity, or is this after the fact?
It is initiated with that activity.
Okay.
So once the estate is open, and that's a term that probably we throw around on the radio program here a little bit, and what we mean by that is the will is put on record after the person has died.
Mm-hmm.
A personal representative is appointed. That's also known as an administrator or without a will, or an executor. If there is a will naming who the executor is going to be, that letters of testamentary are issued. So this is this normal process after someone passes away of the probate of a will.
Mm-hmm.
So once that happens, then the statute of limitations is a 3-year period from that point in time where a party can come forward and file a will caveat. And that will, when it's filed, it looks like a complaint in a lawsuit. I mean, you're making all your allegations and you know, you're serving everyone. That goes to the clerk of court. The clerk of court then is going to transfer that up, what we oftentimes say, upstairs. Mm-hmm. To Superior Court.
Right.
And also, when we file a caveat, we send over with it a order for the clerk to enter consistent with the caveat statutes that freezes the estate. So that's a big deal, too, because, you know, the statutes are clear that, you know, once a caveat is filed, then only very limited expenditures from the estate are allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes sense because we don't want to, fight over an estate, over a will that's going to control how the assets are going to pass. And then those very assets are being spent on things like attorney's fees by the party who is the original under the contested will, beneficiary under the will.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So we have to freeze everything because we really don't know how the assets are going to pass until the jury comes back and says, this is the will, this is the will, this is the will, whichever one it may be. So that's a part of that process. You know, another thing, as I'm talking here, I'm reminding myself of additional points to make. So another thing would be that, you know, when you file a caveat, the appropriate way to go about dealing with which will is the will is for all of the interested parties should, during the caveat proceeding, come forward with any will that they think is the will. What I'm saying is this. It's not that when the last will and testament is put on record and the probate starts, that we have a caveat of that will, and then it takes us back maybe to a previous will, and we have another caveat, Lockwood, is that if there are any wills, they all need to be brought before the court, and the jury will make a determination as to which one is the final will.
Right.
Because it could be we had like a battling will kind of situation, mm-hmm. where a family member or family members were taking, you know, mom or dad or grandma, whomever it was, you know, putting wills in front of them right before they passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be that the final will by date goes away. It could be the one before that goes away. It could be that it was one 20 years ago, and maybe that's the one that stands. So we deal with all of the documents and in a single caveat, And if there's not a will, a prior will, and the will that is set aside or that's being challenged is in fact set aside by the court, the jury, based on their determination, then we end up with a situation where the person has died what we call intestate, meaning without a will.
Okay.
So that means that the assets pass consistent with the North Carolina general statutes for intestacy.
That brings up another question altogether. So in the case of, and we'll probably get to this at the later in the program, but in the case of the jury deciding that none of the wills are satisfactory, I'll use that description, then it goes back to, if you will, to zero, as if there is no will whatsoever.
Yep.
Wow.
That's correct.
As we are talking with Wes Collins about this, of course, the issue of challenging the wills, it goes to the point we've talked about on numerous occasions with Cecil and Wes, and that is the necessity of being very precise and organized and I'll use the word again, precise in the development of the wills and doing so in a very professional manner.
That's right, Lockwood. And also what we're beginning to see here with Wes talking is that, you know, North Carolina law is going to support the integrity of a will. Uh-huh. A last will and testament is a very important document. It's a document that the courts want to enforce. They want to honor, it makes sense, the will, if you will, of a testator, their desires, their wishes. So when a will is set aside, if you will, then that's a very serious circumstance, because now the courts are basically saying that the will, the desire, the direction of the testator is not going to be honored, and that's a serious event. So you begin to see that there's a jury trial. Isn't that interesting? I mean, so many cases that we handle are not necessarily by statute a jury trial. They are when demanded under certain circumstances, but they aren't just by statute a jury trial. You begin to see that if for some reason the will is held to be invalid for whatever element might have been missing, the bottom line is that the next will in line, mm-hmm, will take precedent before we allow there to be no will at all.
Wow.
And, of course, if there is no will at all because there isn't a preceding will, then, of course, finally, yes, the assets will pass according to statute or intestate succession in North Carolina. So it's an interesting, it's a very interesting body of law, isn't it, Lockwood?
It is. And, again, it confirms and as we prepare to go to the break here, I just want to make a comment. This confirms what you've been saying, Cecil and Wes, that the wills are vital. And as I'm listening to this, I'm realizing that it's considered probably one of the most important documents in the court, or if you will, in the public domain. It is one of, if not the most important document, as you're sharing with us, just the aspect of how to contest a will, let alone the fact that if these wills do not meet muster, then the deceased dies intestate without a will. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We've got joining us today Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And again, I want to remind you, if you have any interest in either this conversation or other thoughts and conversations we've had in the past, feel free to give them a call. 252 area code 726-9050. Again, 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. As we continue the program, we have, as I mentioned earlier, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins with us today, and we're talking about the issue of challenging wills. And we just heard a few moments ago, both Cecil and Wes are confirming, or if you will, I would say even stressing the fact that wills are a very vital document, not only for the beneficiaries of the will, but also just the distribution for the benefit of a, if you will, confidence of the state. Cecil, Wes, continue. This is the whole issue of contesting a will indicates how vital this document is.
Well, other things I would say about it, I mean, obviously the process of contesting a will is a very complicated process. You know, mm-hmm. these are not, this isn't something that a non-attorney does.
Oh, my goodness.
as I say quite often, I mean, you wouldn't even get off the runway, without having, I mean, you really need to have someone who deals with in these issues,
mm-hmm.
Not just an attorney, but someone who understands the nuances, the details, the ins and outs of how all this works. Otherwise, your case is going to, there are going to be mistakes made, and probably mistakes that cause irreparable harm, and you're not going to be able to recover from it.
Mm-hmm.
So very, very complex. So as we talk about how important a will is as well, it's interesting when we're dealing with legal documents in the world of wills and deeds and these important documents that transfer people's life work to life's work and life savings, mm-hmm. to their loved ones or whomever they want to leave them to. We're in such a electronic world these days. Everything is email, and a lot of the court systems are becoming all electronic. The federal court is completely electronic. Mm-hmm. The state of North Carolina is becoming more and more electronic from county by county, mm-hmm. as far as the filing goes. But as it relates to wills and deeds, and let's focus on wills, we're still in a position of good old paper. And, I mean, just original document. So you cannot, and we talked about this on the program before, you cannot take to the courthouse a copy of a will, no matter how pretty it is, and after the person has passed away, and put it on record for the probate process to commence.
Mm-hmm.
That's not allowed. If you have the original, then that is what's required. So, as Cecil indicated, not only is the court going to support the validity of wills and try to support those, it's also important, and the court recognizes you have to have the original. Now, there's a process for being able to use a copy, of a will, but it's a somewhat of a mini litigation, quasi-litigation process itself.
Mm-hmm.
So as we've talked about before, not only is it so very important to, make sure that the process for executing a will is handled perfectly with the appropriate witnesses,
right.
at a time, certainly when the person has the capacity to sign the will, when the person is, certainly with much transparency, not in a position where they would be subjected to undue influence, just a very neutral situation where this person gets to make their own decision. Not only is all of that so very important, well, once we go through all of that and we make sure that is done, well, let's not lose the will.
Right. Yeah. But, I apologize for interrupting here, Wes, but you and Cecil have consistently, driven home the fact that, professionalism, number one, accuracy, precision, but also, I'm going to use the word perfection. That is, to perfect the will, to make sure that it is pure and also secure. And Yeah, I can well imagine the effort on the part of family members sometimes to want to introduce something that is not does not meet all those standards. Maybe with the best intentions, but I again stress the importance of doing this correctly at the very outset. I apologize there, Wes.
Yeah, well, no, Lockwood, you're so correct. And, you know, once again, good old Murphy's Law. I mean, where is the original will? We take it out and we're 85 years old and we start writing on it because we don't realize that it's the original. Mm-hmm. We mark through this, we mark through that on the original document. Maybe we take the document out and we leave it out, and then some member of the family finds it. They maybe don't like what it has to say, mm-hmm. And so now that will is gone forever. I mean, things like this are the kinds of things that happen, and we just have to be very protective of our last will and testament and the original of it at that.
All right. So the fact that we've got to worry about having the actual document. Wes, going back to the issue of challenging that document, obviously, and you said, I found this interesting as well, a 3-year statute of limitations once the will is put on record. So how do you either address this as a defense or as a plaintiff in this case?
Right. Well, I mean, obviously, you know, looking at the 3-year statute of limitations, I mean, you got to look at the details of what's going on. I mean, sometimes you might have a situation where you have, you know, someone come to you maybe 2.5 years after mm-hmm. the estate was open, and now the estate is closed, and they're saying, well, we want to challenge this will because, whatever reason, undue influence, lack of capacity, you know, whatever it may be. And, you know, so then we have to recognize that there's a process in order to go, you know, to go through that because, see, the estate's closed. So then the estate needs to be reopened in order for us to be able to file the caveat. You can't as a executor of an estate, I mean, let's say that you're the executor, but you have worry mm-hmm. that mom who passed away signed this will, leaving everything to you, leaving your siblings out at a time when she wasn't doing very well. Right. Maybe it was the day before she died or within the week or the month, and she wasn't doing well. So a couple of things. I mean, you can't avoid a will caveat, you know, by not opening the estate. Okay, that's one thing, because if you don't open the estate, the will that's in question isn't going to be probated, and the assets are not going to pass under that will. So that's the first thing. Second thing is you can't avoid a will caveat by acting quickly. You can't open the estate, move as fast as you possibly can, and there's some waiting periods. You know, some people say, well, why does it take 6 months to deal with administration? You know, why, or 4 months or 8 months or whatever it may be? Well, because the North Carolina General Assembly has, in our North Carolina General Statutes, has imposed some particular waiting periods for claims to be made, for notices to go out mm-hmm. to creditors. So we have to, you know, in many cases, you know, we're waiting for those time periods to go by, and if you haven't done it, the court's not going to close the estate.
Right.
So, but you can't, let's say, rush the administration in an attempt to try to avoid someone from challenging the will. Because if the estate is closed and the person comes back, like I said, 2.5 years later, well, there's a process for reopening the estate.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that process probably would, in most cases, would require us to, if we were handling it, contact the executor and ask them to reopen the estate because it's our intent to proceed with a caveat. And in the event that they don't do that, then we would have the authority to reopen it ourselves. Uh-huh. So that we can proceed with that. So there's a lot of little nuances and details there that, you know, if you just don't understand how it works, it could be very frustrating to you. But a caveat is going to spin out of and administration of an estate, whether the estate's currently open, which is the way it normally is. Because normally, you know, caveats, we don't recommend for folks to wait for 2.5 years or however long it may be, because once the will goes on record, it becomes public record. And then if there's problems with it, well, that's the time to deal with it, because as time goes on, you know, it may be, 3 years isn't a big deal, but sometimes it may be harder to get things like bank records, like phone records, sometimes medical records, certainly witnesses, memories fade over time. So we want to act, you know, relatively quickly, you know, when we think there is a legitimate, you know, basis to bring a caveat case, not wait until the last second.
Certainly. Okay, Wes, let's say, for example, an estate is closed, and I show up 2 years later. I've been overseas or what have you, and I say, I question this will, and I come to you, and my justification is reasonable in your opinion to pursue with a caveat, because you're obviously going to be very cautious about this to begin with.
Absolutely.
As we mentioned in the past. However, the estate was closed 2 years ago. Expenditures have been made. What happens to, and as you said earlier, in the case of a caveat, once it's sought, or I guess would be levied against the estate, everything is frozen. But, you know, 2 years later, obviously some expenditures have been made. What happens with those expenditures in that situation?
Right. Well, we're not in a position to be able to claw those back while the caveat is pending.
Okay.
So let's say there's, for lack of a better explanation, more accurate explanation, let's say $100,000 went out to a particular person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the estate is closed. We reopen the estate, we file the caveat, and we go to the court and we say, well, that $100,000 shouldn't have gone out to that person, and we won't claw it back. Well, there's really no statute that allows the court to require that to be clawed back. Now, I could file a motion and try to get some relief from the court and so on and so forth, but it's not something I could say that there's a really high likelihood of success of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say we proceed forward with the caveat, and we win the caveat, and the previous will leaves everything to the $100,000 to my client.
Right.
Well, at that point in time, we've got a wrongful distribution that took place of $100,000 to this person who received it. So we would have the right under that to it probably would be a second lawsuit, actually, to sue them for that. Now, can the court enter an order requiring them to return that? Maybe through the clerk of court we could do something like that. We'd have to look at it. Or it would be, I think we would have an election of our remedy there. We'd either be able to go to the clerk now that we have this will and require assets to be delivered back to the clerk. We've certainly been successful with that before. We've done that before. Or we'd have to file a lawsuit against the person and get a judgment and collect against that judgment. We probably would want to try to go through the clerk, because that would be more of an order, where there's an order entered by the clerk indicating that these assets need to be returned to this estate for proper probate. In that order, because the clerk's doesn't have the authority to enter a money judgment. It would be a order. So if they don't do that, then you go down the path of contempt of court, which means that the person who got the $100,000 who didn't now return it, if they're found in contempt, well, okay, you didn't return it, you go to jail until you do.
Right.
So, you know, there's some processes for doing it. But let's say that the assets are completely gone. Let's say that the $100,000 got spent.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that the person has no assets. Well, we might be in a situation where we can't collect. We just have to, you know, take that on a case-by-case basis.
All right.
So it's better to act sooner rather than later, so everything's frozen. So go ahead.
No, before we wrap it up, real quick question for you. And, of course, we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, and that was Wes Collins just a few moments ago. As a matter of fact, he's been pretty much giving us all of the details of the issue of challenging wills. And I've got to say, the one thing that I'm taking away from this, Wes, is not only the difficulty of challenging, but also the complexity, the seriousness of it, but also, as a result, the seriousness of creating a good will and testament. Again, utilizing the services of, and I'll be blunt, Harvell and Collins, or a good attorney. And that, I think, is very important. What is the normal length of time, and this may not be an easy answer, but length of time in the process of a caveat? What kind of time frame are we talking about from the moment that a caveat is entered to the conclusion?
I'd say at least a year.
Wow.
At least a year. We have to get in line with regard to other jury matters. So we're going to be competing for time with regard to other jury cases. So, it takes a while, and believe it or not, we're still, I think, somewhat, suffering from the, approximately 1 year shutdown of the court with the COVID. I mean, I think that there's still backlog, where things got slowed down. I mean, the world of litigation is so back to back to back to back to back. I mean, that's just the way it is. I mean, things are all moving at their different pace, but there's just a lot. And then when you interrupt that for a period of time, it takes a while to then catch up. So it's just like any other lawsuit of any significance. Now, if you had a small claims lawsuit or maybe some other types of cases, you get those done pretty quickly. But this is, kind of a bigger ticket thing in the Superior Court.
Well, as you've pointed out, I might add the fact that there's a lot of details that you go into, as we talked about last week, the fact that you're looking into medical records, you're trying to find all the details that you possibly can. With that, Wes, I appreciate your time today. We're talking with Wes Collins there a few moments ago, Harvell and Collins, and Cecil, of course, I want to thank you as well for your time. And again, we're talking about the importance of wills and doing them accurately. If you want to find out more information about this and other items we've talked about, let me remind you, give them a call, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050, or go online for more information about the firm and all the services they offer at harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, Wes, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Lockwood.